Comedians go too far all the time. And that's the whole point, to find the lines you shouldn't cross and then plow right through them. Sometimes they succeed and expand our minds, and other times they fail and expose their own flaws.
But when comedians who criticize the president go too far, is the intensity of the outrage fueled mostly by right-wing propaganda. Today, writer Derek Clifton joins us to take a look at Kathy Griffin, Stephen Colbert, and Bill Maher, the outrage over comedians who say outrageous things.
Plus, the other reason why Wendy Williams lost her Drag Race gig.
How to win at life by defining your own success.
And Tyler Perry's sequel for Madea's Halloween, and why LGBT folks love to dress up. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Right now, you have Feast of Fun in your ears because for the last 13 years, a listener just like you took the time to support this one-of-a-kind, in-depth programming. If you like the show, please make a donation at feastoffun.com/donate. And if you didn't like the show, make a donation anyway to help us improve.
This Thursday, former head of the FBI, James Comey, will be testifying before Congress in what many are calling the Super Bowl of Washington. A lot are hoping that Comey's testimony will be like Nixon and Watergate, showing the beginning of Trump and the Republican Party's downfall. Meanwhile, a lot of comedians have been in trouble for crossing the line, and it's blowing up so fast. Is this just more astroturfing to distract us from the big stories? Joining us today is Derek Clifton, a freelance writer for NBC News, The Root, and Quartz Digital Magazine. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Derek.
Thanks. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Contain your excitement. Hey, so you are the son of a preacher man.
Yes.
And you grew up watching Tyler Perry's plays.
That and so many others. It was just like, if it wasn't Christian, it pretty much wasn't in my house.
Really?
Now, did you watch the videotapes of, like, back in the day? Because he used to sell, or his DVDs of his shows, or did you actually go to the live shows?
It was a mix of the DVDs and maybe once or twice watching the shows. I went to so many of those kind of gospel-y plays that I've lost count, but yeah.
Now, when you went to see the Tyler Perry shows, did you actually show up on time?
Yes.
Oh, so you weren't one of the people that came in 20 minutes late and he would yell at them from the stage.
No, I'll be laughing at those people.
Okay. Because he actually like kind of worked that into the script, right?
Yeah, no way. I mean, he already had ad-libs prepared. Mm-hmm. You could tell that he was ready to break out of character and predictably get to the people who were coming into the theater 20 minutes late, scooting over people to get their tickets. I mean, we've all been there at some point ourselves, so you can kind of relate to them, but you're also kind of like, better you than me.
Yeah. Now, did you ever see My Arms Are Too Short to Box with God?
No,
I okay. did not.
Because that was a play that was happening in Chicago.
And they had aired, like, had commercials for it for years on television. I'm like, who sees this show?
The reason we're sort of talking about this is because Tyler Perry in his last movie, Madea Halloween, he incorporated a lot of viral celebrities, like a lot of YouTube stars, as secondary actors in the film, which I thought was really great to see these people sort of involved in a film, you know.
Yeah, and I think he's doing that again for this next sequel to the Madea Halloween movie. It's supposed to be coming out later this year, I think.
Yeah. Probably and around Halloween.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
And I think he recently casted the woman who does the character Miss Shirlene, who's like this really, like, I don't know, like, debonair church lady who has, like, opinions on everything, but she's just outlandish, and her fashion is very, very Madea in a way, but let's say not as plus sized.
Now, do you feel like Tyler Perry's movies are as funny as they could be, or like all they could be? Like, you know, we're fans of Tyler Perry's movies, but we're also a fan of drag. And I feel like drag in some ways is built on failure. It's kind of like those Fluvogs. Have you seen, gone to the lake? Those, you know, ships that people built.
Oh, like, yeah, the Red Bull.
Yes.
The Red Bull. What are they? Not Fluvogs.
Those
Flutogs.
Flutogs, right? Yeah. And the whole point of drag is to see something crash and burn, is to embrace the rawness and an organic kind of grassroots feel. And I feel like Tyler Perry's movies, you know, people want them to be slicker and more well written, but he writes and produces all that stuff. It's coming out of one man's mind, you know? And in a lot of ways, because it's not this like ironed out Hollywood experience, it feels very much like an auteur's work of art, in that its strong, its strengths and its failures makes it what's so endearing to people.
I think there's some rawness about it that appeals to folks because it doesn't feel as so overthought, so polished. At the same time, like, there was an article that recently came out where he talked about how his creative process works. And, you know, most writers, when you're writing for the screen, whether it's, you know, TV or movies, you get notes back on, you know, your copy. And he says, no, I don't get any notes back. Oprah does not send him notes. She's lets him.
Oprah wanted to give notes. Yeah.
And usually she would. She's very hands on. So there are a lot of writer friends of mine who were like, are you kidding me? The notes make me better as a writer. How did and they kind of felt it was kind of arrogant. And I'm like, OK, they may have a point, though. Like, I think he could be funnier, and I think he can maybe take a little bit of the moralizing and some of the stereotypes out of these movies, especially as it relates to, like, you know, black man, you need to be more dominant, woman, you stay in your place. And I'm like, I could do without all the kind of like moral happily ever after lessons. Just if you're going to give us funny, give us funny. If you want to give us drama, give us drama.
Well, and maybe that's why I say to people is like, may your success come slowly, so your wisdom grows along with your success. And in some ways, Tyler Perry is so big and so commercially, financially successful that he's kind of like George Lucas. No one can tell him no. And so if, you know, Tyler Perry wants to do a 15-minute fart sequence with Madeir, it's going to happen.
I think I could watch that for a couple minutes.
For a couple minutes. You know what I'm saying? So this Thursday, James Comey is going to be testifying before Congress. Everybody's like crossing their fingers like, please, you know, just say that Trump was obstructing justice. Trump is organizing a speech during his testimony to compete, and he's also saying he's going to be live tweeting during the event. And you know, Spicy says that all of President Trump's tweets are official presidential statements now. And so you were saying, Mark, that that now people can't be banned by Trump's Twitter account.
They're challenging. There's an organization, the Knight First Amendment Institute, they sent a letter to Trump saying, hey, because this is really an official means of your communication, you can't ban people from Twitter who are critical of you because you're impinging on their First Amendment right, because you're a government. And that's what the First Amendment right is that the First Amendment, because people talk about free speech and what is free speech and how can you use it. And free speech is defined by the Constitution is the government impinging on your ability to express yourself. And so by him banning people from his Twitter account is him impinging upon their First Amendment right to free speech.
Meanwhile, a lot of people are sort of crossing their fingers and hoping that James Comey's testimony, it's, you know, I think most Americans are over Trump. They're ready to see him go. They're ready to see him be impeached. He's certainly done enough stuff to qualify him for impeachment, but they'd like to see political pressure to see him resign and maybe take a lot, you know, the vice president, a lot of his appointees. Really bring down the Republican Party down with it. And so right now the Republicans are in, you know, cover up mode. And with that happens, you know, we've seen in the last election, there's been a lot of money being poured in to make superficial news stories bigger than they really are. And I'm starting to notice this with, you know, Stephen Colbert calling Trump's mouth only good for sucking Putin's dick.
He was a cock holster.
Cock holster with Kathy Griffin holding the severed head of Trump, which everyone's like, oh, Kathy's joined ISIS. Meanwhile, you know, Wonder Woman brought in $100 million in the box office, and it's pretty much the same plot. She, you know, stabs the bad guy, in the heart. And spoiler alert. And then of course
there's one of the bad guys, we should say.
Yeah. There are many bad guys in the movie.
She kills a lot of guys.
Yeah. And then Bill Maher, Bill Maher says a lot of racist, a lot of offensive stuff, and all of a sudden
over the years,
him saying House N-word then becomes this big, you know, insurmountable issue. Derek, you're a person who works in media and in journalism. What do you make about this accusation or somehow that these stories are being blown up bigger And maybe even being pushed on social media to be bigger stories in order to distract us from the major news story this week, which is Comey's testimony.
Hmm. I mean, there's some truth to that, but, you know, a smidge. I think usually with most things, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. I think oftentimes when you have comedians who, you know, make big controversial statements like they do through their work, you get people wanting to find an escape from news that is otherwise, you know, kind of demoralizing, kind of depresses you, makes you feel kind of crap about, you know, how things are looking in terms of politics and civic engagement. And so you want to kind of divert your attention for a moment. People do that. We especially in the age of social media where there's so much to distract us. Right. But when we're talking about what the press can sometimes do and the power they have to set an agenda, then yes, you know, for some people, this is going to totally derail them from thinking about Comey. But even so, I mean, at least with two of the examples, with Kathy Griffin and with Stephen Colbert, they're topical. They're about Trump in some kind of way. And that's part of why, because they're using their platforms as comedians to antagonize, to provoke, to make you think in a different way. And to push the envelope. That's what comedians are here to do in large part. Now, whether they got it right or they got it wrong or they crossed a line or another is always the debate. Whenever you have any word like the N-word involved, whether you have something like the simulation of a beheading involved, or even when you talk about somebody filleting another person, you're going to stoke controversy. So,
and that's the point of it. And that's the point of these comedians, is to kind of get that kind of controversy going. Now, I think Stephen Colbert is saying that Trump is Putin's cock holder or cock holster. It's, you know, it's a throwaway line. It really doesn't mean much. But a lot of gay people, or some gay people, I should say, found it kind of homophobic, because here you are taking an act that we do, and most of us do quite well, although there are some exceptions where people use too much teeth.
He's talking about me.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
But or other people, we've all had those experiences, yeah. And so it's, you know, you threw me off anyway. What was I saying?
Wonderful blowjobs.
So about the blowjobs. So anyway, you know, it's really nothing, and there's nothing to apologize for. It's just, it's kind of funny because, hey, listen, straight people give blowjobs too. And yes, I want to be sex positive, but you're trying to say that there is an intimate relationship between these two people, that there's something going on there beyond, and, you know, that there's something happening there. And as far as Kathy Griffin goes, you know, I think that's interesting is, again, she said in the same ways, was kind of like when she did her press release or her press conference last week, I think it was on Thursday or Friday, she said that she was working with this photographer. It was a last minute kind of idea. They came up with it. They got a head and they got to put some blood on it, or ketchup on it, I think it was.
Well, who has
ketchup.
A severed head of Donald Trump sitting around in their photo studio?
She said she sent her assistant to the costume store and they bought a mask. So they just stuffed it full with Kleenex and then they put ketchup on it. They took this photo, they put it out there, and she did apologize because there were people that were really offended by it. There were people whose families have been beheaded by, like, ISIS and places like that. And so in her way, her apology was towards them. And she's like, I'm sorry you were offended by this. I'm sorry this shocked you. And I'm sorry this scared you. But then she decided she was going to have this press conference. And her attorney, who is Gloria Aldred's daughter, got up there and defended her and said, listen, right now, you might not like what she did, but it's a comedian's job to do this kind of stuff. It's a comedian's job to shock people and to provoke the people and get people thinking about these kinds of ideas. And we've seen this a long time in the past. We've seen effigies of presidents being burned before, and no big deal. But this one has been kind of blown up because Trump and Trump's family have started using Twitter and attacking her personally. Whereas, like, when you'd see something like Obama's being hung, Obama wouldn't even recognize it. He wouldn't talk about it. But because it was beneath him. But with Trump, it's like he's trying to punish her, also trying to make this like a big news, like, hey, look at me, I'm the victim here.
Well, because Trump has this sort of teenage mentality that he wants to be the victim always, even if he is president of the United States. Even if he's the de facto head of the Republican Party right now.
And even when he's the aggressor in some cases, right?
Yeah, without a doubt.
I mean, you know, leaving the Paris Accord, putting the environment aside is going to devastate. If we permanently leave this Paris Accord, it will devastate the United States economically for generations, for the rest of our lives and their children's lives and their children's and children's so
the,
lives.
But the Republicans have the exact opposite feelings that we're actually losing out on money because we have stopped production of some things, whereas we're allowing China to actually pollute a lot. But although the scientists say the United States already pollutes way more than China anyway.
We're the world's number one polluter. Mm-hmm. So you can't go number one over number one. And certainly the idea that you're going to intentionally harm yourself technologically, that you're going to hold back on emerging. Here's an example. The 25% economic growth on solar energy jobs is the fastest growth sector. If you want to invest in your money in something, if you want a future career, we should all stop podcasting and stop doing journalism and entertainment and learn how to install solar panels.
I thought about it.
You're going to be rich, basically, if you get into the solar business. I think with the Bill Maher's, can we talk about the context of this? He was talking to a senator, I believe,
from Nebraska, and he told him, hey, you should come out and work the fields in Nebraska. And then Bill Maher says, you got me all wrong. I'm a house N-word, referring to African-American slaves who worked in the house rather than in the fields.
Yeah. And Derek, what was your response? Because you were very vocal on social media about it. And
honestly, for me, Bill Maher has been irrelevant for years. So I try not to give it too much of my energy because, mm-hmm. There's so much out here that's, getting me all riled up. And I try to just protect what I allow to get me outraged. But about this one in particular, I'm like, seriously, Do you not recognize that you are a white man and the fact that you are using the N-word period is going to piss a lot of people off? Like, some people are like, okay, so he knows the distinction between a quote unquote the house N-word and the field N-word. Even that is fraught in the community, especially since, for me, like, for example, like, if you were a light skinned person, mm-hmm. you're talking about colorism and you're talking mm-hmm. about who was more accessible or, closer in proximity to the master, then it'll be the lighter skinned, slaves, because they were seen as being closest to being white and thereby more acceptable and desirable. And so for him to use that phrase in that way, even in context, was just off base and terrible. And to see so many black people who are prominent and even others who are not black defending him is off-putting. But also what I do not like about this moment and so many others like it is that it resurges this debate about who's allowed to say the N-word and who isn't, and when is it okay to say it and who isn't. And if you say the N-word, right, does it make you racist? And I think even talking about podcasting here, I believe it was in 2015, I think I wrote about this, Mark Marone on, I believe it was his podcast, where, Obama had an interview and he said, the measure of whether or not you're racist should not be whether or not you think it's okay to say or use the word, the N-word. Mm-hmm. He said it flat out. He didn't censor himself. People were like, oh, my God, the president said the N-word. And I'm like, so?
Mm-hmm. I bet, though, when Mark Maron, when he said that, it was like, thank you, Jesus.
People are going to listen to this podcast now.
Get to get the president of the United States on your show, and then him saying something that he's seldom says mm-hmm. anywhere else.
He did say it in his book, though, did he not? In the audio book.
So, but yeah. It's not something you like wakes up in the morning is like, hello, America, N-word, it's not like RuPaul's song. You've heard that song, right? No. RuPaul has a song that the N-word is the only
word in it,
and it just repeats all the
time. I don't know if you can buy it on iTunes.
It's not on iTunes anymore.
But she did record it.
Yeah.
She did record
Shirley it. Shirley Kulicker did the in-between. Okay.
Of course Shirley Kulicker did.
Oh, God. What's your thought? I usually never give an attention to Shirley Kulicker because she's somebody who's, not worth mentioning, but it's, because I do believe, unlike other drag queens, Chuck Nipp, the man who creates this character, he's sincerely interested in doing something harmful to African Americans, And at the same time, he also is a drag queen and he's interested in failure and in being a mess. But like we went to see his show, her show here in Chicago. She didn't really care too much about learning her own material. Like, the audience knew her material more than she did. Mm-hmm. And she was just interested in being a large drag queen in blackface. That was the point of the show. There was nothing else to it. And so she starts opening up her act and asking for questions from the audience. And of course, me sitting says, you know, you want to get offensive? Let's get offensive. How much do you weigh?
Oh, she did not like that.
She was like, oh, now you've gone too far.
She was mad.
She was so mad. She almost like she almost had me kicked out or something.
But she's the one in blackface, so. Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was like, you know, I had an open mind. I wanted to see it. I wanted to see what the, because this was one of the first times a viral sensation had an on. It was like, this was not a mainstream media. This was an internet thing.
This is pre-YouTube.
Yeah. And so we were there, and it was like the audience, it just felt, it didn't feel right. It didn't feel warm. It didn't feel out of, you know, and RuPaul says it's coming from a place of love, a love for racist things. and that's what I, like, to me, like, bothered me. Then we interviewed RuPaul and we asked her about it. And then Shirley Kulaker took that interview and edited it to make it seem like it was said the opposite of what we were asking and discussing about. So she actually edited it to say the opposite and made us sound like we were endorsing Shirley Kulaker and RuPaul, and we were enjoying about laughing about, you know, racism and stuff. And so Jasmine Kanick,
do you know her?
No, she's an NPR columnist, got a hold of this and was like, basically, Feast of Fools at the time is race, the racist monsters. Look at this, you know, and stuff. And I'm just like, motherfucker, you know, so that's why I have no love for Shirley Kulaker. Anyways. Why am I bringing this up?
Oh, because of Bill Maher.
Bill Maher and comedians, yes, crossing this line. And, mm-hmm, you know, to me, it's like, and we've had, there's been a lot of conversations about entertainers, about, you know, going too far. And, you know, that's their job, is to make these horrible, deadly mistakes.
I have to say, right? Though, when I first saw Kathy Griffin's picture, it did shock me a little bit. And I'm thinking, it's like, is this really the right kind of thing to do? But then as like the more I thought about it, the more I'm just like, well, I don't like Trump very much either. Now, I'm not saying he should have his head cut off, but it was like, you know, in many ways, it's like cut the head off of the Republican Party and maybe it will die.
It's a seven-headed hydra. Yeah. As Wonder Woman, I don't want to spoil out tomorrow's show is about Wonder Woman, but it's like, you know,
it's Captain America who fights Hydra.
Yeah, but Wonder Woman says, it's like, you know, in the movie they make a point. There's, mm-hmm, good and evil in the hearts, mm-hmm, of all mankind. You know, mm-hmm, and that, you know, you have to fight the Republican Party in your heart for it to die. You know, mm-hmm, you have to fight that temptation, that bit desire to hurt and oppress others and to make yourself feel better about yourself. Because one thing I've discovered is that, and they've done a lot of studies about this, that people who are very conservative politically hate knowing that someone else has more than them. So, like, for me, like, I'm just happy with my life and I'm moving on. And I don't really care too much. I don't really think too much about whether my neighbors are doing better or worse. I want everybody to be happy. I want everybody to be their needs met. And it doesn't, me having something doesn't diminish it in value knowing someone else has that too. Right. But for conservative people, knowing that someone else has the same things they do, it makes them jealous. It makes them angry and makes them petty.
Is that why they fought so hard against marriage equality? Because, yeah, like, we have marriage equality. We have marriage. You can't have it, because if you have it, it will devalue what I have.
She already had hers, as a rule. And so I don't know. It's like, you know, do you feel like with all this stuff, like, I'm curious to hear your thoughts as a gay black man about comedians sort of crossing the line. I don't know if you got to catch Dave Chappelle's Netflix special.
Not yet.
And so he started bringing up like terminology about transgender people and he was crossing the line. And to me, it's like, I think it's not the words and it's not the necessary, it's the associations, it's the thoughts behind these words. And to me, it's like, when the associations are still ugly, they're still brutal, we need to really look at why this entertainer is using these, bringing up these things. And are they trying to expand consciousness? Are they trying to spark a conversation, or are they just bringing a platform to ideas that and people that really belong in the fringes of society? And like you said, like Bill Maher's show, you know, is relevant. It, you know, he's giving a platform to, you know, the people who shouldn't be famous. We should not know who Ann Coulter is. We should not know who Milo Yiannopoulos is. But we do know, and part of that comes from Bill Maher's show.
Mm. And it's part of because what oftentimes what you do when your show's ratings are kind of meh and you're fading into irrelevancy like he's been, you will debase your platform to get the most controversial, fringe, outlandish, mm-hmm. offensive voices you can get and play them up for ratings or for controversy. I mean, you could even look at what Out Magazine did when they glorified Milo Yiannopoulos, mm-hmm. and painted him as a court jester, which we know, of course, has a very fraught history in terms of, you know, representations of black people in the mainstream media. When we talk about the watermelon and fried chicken mm-hmm. stereotype, the song that was created with it, you know, the Sambo, there's so many. And you're thinking, why do you feel that deserves wider amplification when there's so many other people, so many voices, so many untapped perspectives from marginalized communities that we need to be holding up at the center? You know,
and meanwhile, Nina Bonina, Osama bin Laden, Banana Fofana Brown from RuPaul's Drag Race.
That name's not offensive.
Inner Saboteur doesn't get an article in Out Magazine. You know, and to me, it's like there's all these interesting people to talk to and to talk about. And to me, you know, seeing, you know, and certainly we talked to a lot of people involved with that article and they were protesting and they were almost quit because of it. And the guy who wrote about it, what happened
to
him?
He went on to say that he became a Republican after that.
Yeah, because he became people conservative were bullying him.
Because people were bullying him. And he's just like, these gay people are so intolerant. And I couldn't believe it. And I went to my gay bar and everybody there shunned me because I wrote about him. And it was just, I'm just shocked that I have to turn to Republican cock.
You know. Poor Chadwick.
Have you ever gone home with somebody and you like, you turn on the lights and you see the books on their shelves and you, or the music they listen to, and you're like, fuck, I should not have slept with this person.
Nah. Like there was there was maybe one date I ever went on when the guy basically told me that, oh, I can't do a second date on this day because I have to go to like my like Ayn Rand social meeting. Uh-oh. We have an objectivist reading club. And I was like, this fool just said Ayn Rand. I think that's my exit. Mm. Hey, like, I bet. So that's never going to happen to me. But if I were in that situation, I'd not be happy.
I was, you know, I hooked up with this hot guy. He was like, he had an amazing body. He was beautiful. Beautiful Asian man. Just gorgeous, you know. And we had this really great sex and stuff. And then the sex was over. Turn on the lights. And it was Mormon poster, you know, repent, Rush Limbaugh. It was just like, really? And it was so awkward. It was like, you know, it's like, you know, that scene where you turn on the lights and it's like all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy written in blood on the wall kind of thing. You're like, I got to get out of here. And you're just like, oh, my God, you know. And so, you know, vetting people sometimes is a probably a good thing that I should do more often. But honey, when you get, you know, when you get thirsty, sometimes you just have to have a drink, even if the water's a little bit dirty.
Yeah, but even with like the guy who became Republican after all the quote unquote bullying he got, which we should rephrase as criticism. Mm.
Feedback,
mm-hmm. not bullying. Some people confuse the two. And it connects with this broader trend, mm-hmm. whether it's in France or even here in the United States, where you have some gay men who feel, you know, that the alt-right, you know, the more nationalist, even neo-Nazi kind of viewpoints and perspectives actually appeal to them, and they have no problem with this. And there's article after article coming out about it. And of course, 9 times out of 10, these are gay white men. And I'm like, okay, do you see the common denominator? It's about white nationalism. So, of course, race, you know, is a big part of that. But I'm like, for these guys who are doing it, even the guy who wrote that article, I'm like, do you not see or recognize that those people still do not want you? You are gay. Mm. Like, even if you are white, I don't care how Islamophobic you are or how white nationalist you are, you're still gay. And you're not going to have space in that movement for you to claim any power. So what is this really about? Do you want to be with your people and be with your community, or do you just want to have unabashed power and privilege? And I think that's what it is. When people lose that sense of I have more than you, or you're getting up to where I am, it starts to feel like they're being oppressed, when actually what they're witnessing is more fairness and equity in the world. And even if we have too much, you know, even if we have further to go, even the fact they see just a slither of progress is a threat. And it's sad.
What is that saying? Is like equality feels like oppression when you're used to privilege?
Yes.
Is that how it goes?
Yes.
To me, it's just like, you know, it's kind of an immature mentality, right? It's that like kid with the lollipop can't just enjoy sucking on that pop. Has to go to his friends and taunt them and go, I have one and you don't. Remember Eddie Murphy's
the ice cream cone.
What is? How does that go? It's like, my daddy has money for ice cream and your daddy's poor.
Your daddy's on welfare and you can't afford it.
Yeah. And it's a very immature kind of mentality. And in some ways, like, I think, you know, bigotry and fear, you know, we always think associate children as hearts are pure and stuff, but children can be mean little fuckers, you know, and
some of us grow up. The Golden Girls said kids can be so cruel.
Yeah. And some of us grow up and become better people. And some of us get stuck in that kind of, you know, childhood tauntingness, you know. I'm really interested in hearing you talk about how people define success for themselves, because you speak a lot on as a gay black man about managing your expectations and defining your success on your own terms and not someone else's.
And that's part of it. And you know, just being able to self-determine and have your own self-awareness and, you know, confidence in proceeding in a way that is authentically you. And for me, you know, somebody who doesn't even identify with the gender binary, I've had to take a lot of time over the years to just reconcile with the fact that no matter what I do, no matter how I present myself, there's going to be somebody in some place that does not see me as successfully embodying what it means to be a masculine male. And what has that meant for me? It's meant some difficulty, some stereotyping, you know, being pushed out of certain spaces. But even with that, I found that it feels so much better to just approach people and just have your one-on-one kind of unique understanding with others so that you can find ways to connect with them as yourself and not as this appearance of whatever ideals, you know, fit your cultural expectations of what it means to be a man or even what it means to be a woman, if you want to talk about it in that sense. So I think once we kind of get, you know, a little bit less hung up in, you know, holding identity so rigidly and carry them a little bit more lightly, then I feel we're really allowing ourselves some space and some grace to be human.
Is that why LGBT people love Halloween? Because it's this ritualized way of like taking our identities and saying, let's put this in the shelf right now. And today I'm going to be, you know, some wacky, crazy character, or dress up in drag, or be a ghost, or, you know, be something that I'm not normally.
I think that's part of it. You know, I think Halloween's fun, period. I mean, who doesn't like, you know, trying to pretend that they're still like 12 and get free candy when they can? I mean, that's kind of weird, but I don't
I love
do that.
Free candy.
Booty candy. Oh,
but I think, you know, being, you know, to riff off of the title of the most recent, one of the recent Santi Gold albums, Master of My Make-Believe, I think when people can get into the project of self-definition and kind of creating the world in which, you know, they, you know, want to exist in, I think that can be beautiful when you get to that place where you can say, I don't have to follow the script that was given to me. I can start writing and authoring my own script.
Why do you feel like so many people want to follow that script?
It feels familiar. That's part of it, but also because of what's attached to that. Privilege often is attached to that, especially if you're a man, you know, and being able to access certain spaces where you are centered, where you're welcome and others aren't, and being able to reap the benefits of that. And I think we should question that. Like, whenever we're somewhere, who's not here? And who can we be bringing into the center? Who can we bring into the fold? If the table isn't big enough for us to pull up more seats to it, then maybe we need to brush the table aside, build a new one, bring some more chairs to that, and start something else. But folks are, you know, often afraid of, you know, taking the hard way or, you know, trying to, you know, maybe edit or revise how things have been to create something new. It's harder to do that than it is to just go with what's already been considered conventional or normal.
Mm. What did that transgender woman, Love, her last name is Love. She, I forgot her name, but it's not Darlene Love, but
no,
but she made a point. She said that it's Ashley Love. Thank you. She said that it's easier for transgender women of color to come out at a younger age because for them, they feel like there's less to lose. And for white transgender women of of whiteness or non-color, it's harder to give up that white male privilege. And so like someone like Caitlyn Jenner holds on to this white maleness throughout their lives, making themselves unhappy and miserable because it's such a hard thing to give up.
Because there's so much privilege there. There's so many benefits that would be denied you.
And when you have, you know, nothing left to lose, you know, why not try this other identity? Why not explore?
Mm. And you know, I think oftentimes, you know, across a broad range of identities, we are shaped by the circumstances we grew up in and the world that was created for us by the people who claim to love us. Or who actually do love us and mean well, but they make mistakes. They're human too, and so it's hard when you really get a sense of who you are and what your pure essence is, aside from what everybody else tells you you should be and how they think. There's always that battle, right, between what is me and what have I been taught? How much am I holding on to that versus what I'm kind of figuring out to be true based on what I'm experienced by myself and what I've experienced with community? And so it can be difficult to parse that out and to kind of block out those voices who are telling you, live your life this one strict way, have these things, bask in this privilege. That's how it should be. You know, it's easy to cling to that. But it's hard to do the work, the hard work is what my pastors would call it, of just really deeply examining that. What is my attachment to this? Why do I need it? What's stopping me from letting it go? And what will I gain by evolving and moving to a new place?
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, my passion for going to the gym and weightlifting and bodybuilding is it gets criticized a lot. By both people who are on one side of the, you know, that I'm fitting into a male stereotype or that I'm holding on to male privilege. And I'm like, I'm the last person to hold on. You know, I've been in drag and high heeled women's shoes for 25 years of my life, you know, since the age of 18. You know, it's like, let me have, you know, I'm passionate about this. And people, and I noticed this, that when you pursue your passion, whether it's drag, whether it's something that especially modifies your body or distorts it in some way, that people always want to ascribe that you somehow have a mental illness, that your passion is harming you some ways, and that they want to like criticize you for dedicating so much energy and time to pursuing that passion.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, for me, you know, being non-binary, a lot of people who are non-binary or who are gender non-conforming get that kind of response, right? Because, for so many folks, it means appearing or presenting yourself either non-verbally or, you know, physically, or the way you talk, how you express yourself in a way that does not match what they consider to be what society has defined you to be or the gender you were assigned at birth. And to see that represented in a way that's so visceral for folks, it makes them feel uncomfortable. But it's like, why does that make you feel uncomfortable when somebody is living and into themselves and doing it in a way that's not hurting anybody?
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked to, was it Alexandra Billings? And she said, who's a transgender actress, and she said when people see a trans person living their life, it makes them question their own lives. And they're not ready to deal with some of the things in their own life because they're like, this person has become what they want to become, but yet here I am, and I'm not where I am. And so that can make them very uncomfortable.
I've been living a lie.
and it can even be a challenge when you want to present yourself to the world in a way, but you know you can't, or you have limitations to doing that because you have to self-preserve, you have to survive, and you may not be in a place where you can, you know, live into that truth. And for me, you know, it means 9 times out of 10, I can't play around with gender as much as I would want to publicly because I know it could backfire. I know in certain spaces it means I could lose my job. Mm-hmm. It could mean that, you know, I may lose kinship, you know, and at certain point,
it's a hassle.
And at some point, you know, even for gay folks, it's like, okay, at some point you're willing to lose certain parts of your life as you know it to move into something different. But it's always that struggle, and you have to just, it's hard to wrestle with. It's a real strong internal battle.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, and one of the 7 jobs that I have, they're like, oh, we celebrate Halloween, and, you know, we wear little fun little costumes to work. And I'm like, I'll show up in full drag, honey. And they're like, oh, well, no, that's okay. That's okay. That's, you know.
We mean like little like bunny ears.
Or something. A little hat.
Right.
And I'm like, baby, I will come here looking, you know, dead drop gorgeous, you know, looking fierce and fabulous and making them all eat it, sickening, and so on and so forth. You've not been following this season of RuPaul's Drag Race, and a lot of people have been struggling to stay with the show because of its move to VH1. Mm-hmm. We used to be able to catch it on logoonline.com, and no longer. They post the episodes online. You have to buy them either through iTunes or you have to...
Amazon, too, I think.
Or watch them on Brazilian Facebook pages. You know. One of the big things that happened in the beginning of the season of RuPaul's Drag Race that people sort of forgotten was the controversy of having Wendy Williams narrate the in-betweens of the shows, which they quickly got rid of, especially when many of the drag queens from the show, like Alaska and Detox, and even RuPaul, said, I'm not a fan of Wendy Williams, and they felt very much betrayed by VH1's casting her as the queen of gossip, queen of all media, to weigh in on drag queens, even though she's been very transphobic and bigoted against transgender people in the past on her talk show.
Yeah, and to speak to the, you know, earlier point about that move to VH1, you know, I used to be, for me, where when the show came on, like, I think it was like Monday or Tuesday
night. It was Monday night.
It was an event.
I would pause whatever I was doing. When I was in college, I didn't have cable in my dorm. I would go to my friend's house who had Logo. We would all watch together, order pizza. You know, I'd be like, yes, look at that one. They were like, no, girl, that ain't it. Or between ourselves debating who won or lost the lip sync. And now it's like, it's on a Friday night. It's on VH1. Most of us during that time are like just getting off work. We're trying to get ready to go out. We're getting into our weekends. We're not trying to sit down in front of a TV and then you don't even put it online. Come on now.
Well, did they change who's watching it, like the demographics? Because I know that drag is super popular among young teenage girls, and I wonder if they're like, hey, if we have it on a Monday night, these girls are going to be at home, their parents will probably be at home too because it's a Monday night, and they're like, why are you watching the show? Don't you have schoolwork? But if we put it on a Friday, maybe they're babysitting and their parents are out so they can be free to watch it. I don't know, because maybe is that the demographic they're going for? Maybe they don't care about gay men anymore.
Maybe.
RuPaul.dragrace
done fucked up RuPaul's Drag Race.
Because do you watch more TV on a Monday night or do you watch it on a Friday night?
I don't watch any television on Friday or Saturday. Mm. I catch Saturday Night Live the day after.
And then,
Sunday.
Of course, you know, people have like, you know, TiVo or whatever. They can download it and skip through the commercials and watch it. But if you don't have cable, you're screwed.
Why is Wendy Williams, you know, people hate her, have been hating her for a long time, and it was stemming from her trash-talking Whitney Houston.
Oh, she's trash-talked a lot of people over the years. Oh, yeah. Like, I think at one point, you know, she called, like, Whoopi Goldberg an ugly lesbian, but then later on, Whoopi Goldberg came to the show, Wendy cried, you know, was like, oh my God, you came to my show, and then Whoopi was like, you grew up. It's okay. It's okay, baby. You grew up. And Wendy was just crying. But like one of her most infamous interviews amongst a lot of the really outlandish stuff she said was when she was talking so much crap about Whitney Houston on her radio talk show. And then all of a sudden, Whitney calls and they have this long interview. Whitney had time that day. Yes, she did. And Whitney's kind of in weird form in this interview. You know, she's firing off at Whitney, but she also has really just creatively evasive ways to, you know, kind of skirt around Wendy's more offensive questions. You know, like, I think at one point, you know, Wendy talked about, like, you know, the type of sex that she thought her and Bobby were having to her face. And Whitney's like, no.
What kind of sex was it?
I think Wendy termed it as wild hot monkey sex. receipts are on YouTube.
That's wrong.
You know, so Wendy's always been, you know, that kind of provocateur with her, you know, gossip conversations and things like that. But to your point, like, yeah, over the years, she has said a lot of really just flat out problematic shit about trans folks that is just inexcusable. And for that, she's lost a lot of support from the LGBT community, you know, in
pockets.
Does
she have any
support? She's a problematic fave for some people, though. Mm-hmm. So she has some support. I just don't think it landed for this demographic. Yeah.
Can we forgive her? Can we all grow? Can we grow up as a... Can we bring back Wendy Williams into the drag fold, or is it worth it?
I think she blew her chances when she banned, Erica Latour Aviance from her show. Not once, but twice, right?
I think it was three times.
Three times?
Yeah.
She tried to be on the show or like sit in the audience.
The producers kept calling Johnny McGovern and Erica and being like, we're so sorry, come back. And it was like, it's like that, you know, Grindr hookup that keeps standing you up. And every time you go to his apartment, he's not there. And you're like, fool me once, shame on me, fool me you know, it's like, and finally you're just like, this person just enjoys fucking me over. And I think Wendy Williams, to some degree, gets pleasure on hurting other people.
I think there's a meme out there, you know, that has Wendy Williams kind of steeping her tea and smiling all brightly at the camera. And think the caption says, I wish somebody would look at me the way that Wendy Williams looks at other people's misfortunes. and I'm like, yeah. Truth tea. Oh, my God. She deals in muck. She's a gossip person. It's always allegedly, according to Us Weekly, the National Enquirer had this. I have this gossip source in L.A. She always has the heat.
That's why she has her own TV show, because it oppresses people to think that way. If we get pleasure on the misfortunes of others, we can't lift ourselves up as a community. And so when we encourage that kind of thinking, you know, by bringing people like that and giving them their own TV shows. Let's talk about Titus Burgess. Why does he have... He should be a bigger star than he is.
Well, he's on that TV show there, Breakable Kimmy Schmidt, and he's one of the breakout stars.
He's
getting a lot of airtime.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
If there's going to be a spinoff show, Titus is going to happen.
Listen, I love Titus and I love him on that show, but I don't know if I could watch a show that's just based on him. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, it would be written. but I will say, you know, his character, you know, on Kimmy Schmidt is, you know, for some people they're like, okay, is this a stereotype shtick or are you giving me an authentic person? That was definitely the question I had from the first season. And even like this season, you know, if you've seen the second episode, you know, that Titus has, it's like a whole like lemonade sequence, you know, interspersed throughout the whole episode that's like dedicated to one of Titus's relationships that plays out.
It's a reference to Beyonce's. Yeah. Lemonade.
He's got the baseball bat. He's going to show his boyfriend what's what.
Has like the big flowing yellow dress, you know, and the kind of appearance that Beyonce has. It's kind of the nod to the Yoruba goddess Oshun.
It's the idea when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. And so in Beyonce's video, I think she literally smashes a bunch of stuff angrily with a baseball bat.
Yeah, she was expressing that rage.
What was Beyonce's anger at? It was against her husband.
Yeah, you know, that's what the folklore is. Like, it's inferred that, like, because, like, before the video starts, the question is, are you cheating on me? And it kind of echoes. And then next thing you know, the floodgates open. There she is walking down those stairs. Mm-hmm. She gets that baseball bat and just starts going Carrie Underwood, Jasmine Sullivan style, bust the windows before he cheats, all the other stuff. And you're like, wow,
And you know, Jay-Z was in on it because he knows it's like, is he cheating on it, or is like that controversy people are going to talk about?
And that's why Tyus is busting those by that window.
But isn't Beyonce's anger also about racism too? Especially in her Super Bowl performance and the tribute to the Black Panthers.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely
it was an album, right? Yeah. It was part of an album, so Lemonade was one song on this album. So there was other songs that really dealt with
Going to Formation with Rick Frieda. Frieda then, what did she was on government assistance while she was touring with Beyonce or something, and she got into hot water because of
that. I think she paid off that debt.
She paid off that debt, but it was like she had an apartment.
Who's the queen of gossip now? Mm-hmm. Wendy Williams has nothing on Fausto. Big Frieda, this is what you need to do. You need to pay your bills and you need to pay the government back what you owe them, okay? Is that a good Wendy Williams impersonation?
That's pretty good, okay. I guess. But did you remember that story or what happened was like, and to me it was like, you know, that should have been settled behind the scenes, but they wanted to make Big Frieda an example. It was punishing her for being successful, and somebody somewhere was looking for a way to get even with her, you know, and there's so much jealousy too, I think. It's back to this idea. It's like, it's not enough to be successful in your own life. You know, it's about making sure other people don't succeed.
Yeah, something didn't smell right about that story and how it developed, you know. But we also have to think it was also, you know, even before, you know, Big Frieda had that line on the Formation song. Remember, Big Frieda also got the big, you know, Big Frieda Queen of Bounce reality show. So, you know, you have a new introduction to a lot of people to Big Frieda's music. And even like the more recent shows, you know, that Big Frieda's had here in Chicago have been like well attended, if not sold out. And you have all these people in there just twerking, bouncing, you know, just really grooving to the music, and, you know, has this big cultural influence. And also Big Frieda is also, you know, a Black person who, you know, bends our expectations of gender in a really refreshing way. And so when you are taking that kind of a platform and you're, you know, pushing the envelope in that way, people are going to try to find something, anything on you to kind of diminish that light. It's sad.
And Big Frieda is one of those artists that manages to say her name in every single song. Which I really like, because you're always
just to
like,
remind you who's singing. It's Big Frieda.
Big Frieda, come on, you know. So it, to me, it's like it's fun because like and this happened with the Black Eyed Peas in the early albums. Is like, you know, like that song. God, I'm da na 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 na.
Hey mama.
They were working their the name of the group into the song lyrics. Fergie does it, you know, it's a tradition that I think a lot of entertainers do, and I really like that. To somehow, I could listen to Big Frieda say her name forever. and she was on RuPaul's Drag Race, and they had this really with I think it was the season with Bob the Drag Queen, right?
It was the All-Stars.
It was right? All-Stars.
And she was in a scene playing the nurse or something.
Yeah. And she's just like, Big Frieda. Like, that's all she said the entire episode was her name. Like, they didn't give her a lot of lines and stuff, and she's just standing there like, I'm just happy to be here, you know? She has just a great spirit about her.
And I don't know if y'all remember the RuPaul had a song, I think that was tied to the show. Peanut Butter.
Mm-hmm. Peanut butter.
And then Big Frieda comes back, it's Big Frieda, Dark Queen Diva. And I'm like, I just love it. Just burst of new energy to the song.
I didn't like the song the first time I heard it. I was like, this is a fucking annoying song.
Peanut.
Oh, gosh. And of course, they had all the guys in, you know, like really bright colored underwear trying to twerk in the video.
And they know
emphasis on trying.
Well. Trying, yeah.
Were they not doing a good job?
No. I got into hot water because I said that that's not RuPaul's butt. RuPaul has a padded ass. Mm-hmm. And that ass has some jiggle in the video, and I'm like, that's a body double, and it's so clear that RuPaul got an ass body double, and I think that's brilliant that she managed to find somebody who could fit into her dress, because RuPaul's a tall woman, you know, mm-hmm. and she got somebody with a nice, voluptuous booty that jiggles to then cut into her ass jiggling on the video.
I didn't even notice that detail.
I'm not really sure that you're 100% right on that.
I don't think that's RuPaul's ass. There's no way foam jiggles like that.
You know, I can't really say one way or another. I don't know, because I'm like, it could be, it might not be.
My hand on RuPaul's ass from first experience. There's a photo of me with my hand around her waist, and I'm kind of copying a feel, just because
she was also wearing a corset when you met her, because I remember you saying she was really like hard.
Table, that's RuPaul's waist. That waist ain't moving, you know. She is just, she's a man out of concrete, you know. She's like a clay, like Wonder Woman. She probably threw a bullet at her. She would probably bounce it off her wrist or something like that. Or the silicone would, or the foam would stop it. Now, I'm curious to talk about, Jaden Smith and EJ Johnson. We're talking about a little about this. We became big fans of Jaden Smith through the Netflix show, The Get Down. Mm-hmm. And most recently, Magic Johnson's son, EJ, was in this viral image.
Well, there was an image of Magic Johnson, his wife, and then EJ. And underneath it, it said, God gave Magic Johnson one son, and this is who he got. You know, and it was a diss because he's a gender nonconforming person.
And he's very flamboyant in the photo.
Yeah.
And then somebody responded, say, how much money do you have?
What was the response, Derek?
I think the response that went viral was like, EJ Johnson has a fashion line worth $20 million, and you're just a homophobic loser. And I was just like, where's the lie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Order up. I like that, you know. And I think Jaden Smith, you know, he's trying to prove himself. And I'm really interested in how Jaden Smith is being marketed as a gender nonconforming person who may not be gender nonconforming. Like, I don't know if you got to see.
Lady Bunny really planted that idea in your head, didn't she?
No, it was other people have been talking about this on the internet, too. Okay. There was a fashion model shoot where they put Jaden Smith in women's clothes. And in The Get Down, Jaden Smith, there's a scene where he's kind of tripping and he's watching a drag show. And one of the drag queens then is him in drag, you know, and it's not very clearly explained in the show. But of course, all the blogs and all the, marketing for the TV show was like, Jaden Smith is drag, you know, and this is Will Smith's, golden son. It's like and there was all this controversy.
His father couldn't do. Maybe but so. Wanted to. And his mom, too, a little bit, I bet.
Well, and so his father was famously known for pushing to remove the gay kiss from the movie 5 Degrees of Separation, where his character has a gay kiss in the play. And there was rumors that Will Smith pushed or pressured for Jaden Smith not to have because his character is gay in The Get Down. He describes himself as an alien, and he falls in love with another man. And there's a lot of these scenes where they're supposed to kiss, but they never quite kiss. They cut away to just before those lips touch.
Just like his dad. And what was it? The 6 degrees of separation?
Yes.
Was supposed to have
5 degrees, did I say?
Yeah,
six. Some degrees of Kevin Bacon or something like that. And I don't know. It's like, I'm curious that, like, have you ever thought about this, like, the expectations that, because you talk about this a lot, is managing expectations. I wonder, for Jaden Smith and EJ Johnson, who wake up and they're just like, they don't have to worry about paying their bills. What they have to worry about is finding their creative spirit, which in some ways can be a big struggle, but it's a nice struggle to have, isn't it?
I mean, they definitely have platforms that reach a broad array of people, and we can't ignore the fact that oftentimes, almost all the time, it's culture that an art that ends up driving or paving the way for a lot of social and policy progress on a lot of issues. And, for me, it's like, okay, I can, look at somebody like a Jaden or an EJ and think, okay, great for you that you're able to express yourself in this way and embody your identity in a way that is whole and authentic. And even with Jaden, even before, The Get Down was, on Twitter, on social media, being very vocal around issues of gender and gender nonconformity and expressing that in various ways. So, I think the debate about whether or not Jaden is gender conforming or not is a bit fraught, though. I will say that on the whole, when you know, you have the money, you have the financial security and the support, because, you know, EJ has support, Jaden has support, versus, you know, let's say a black kid on the west side of Chicago that doesn't have that and has to travel through the streets alone at night and getting home from school and facing bullying, taunting, violence, you know, maybe even resistance in the home or threats of being, you know, disowned. You know, that's a different experience. And it takes a lot more when you don't have that security or that support to get to the place where, you know, a Jaden or an EJ is. It takes nothing away from them. But I think we have to just be honest and acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm. So how can we be the change that we want to see in others? Like, in, you know, to wrap this all up, because I really enjoy that you came over on the show and spent an hour talking. We're sort of like talking about these comedians and crossing the line, but it really is like the podcast is really about, you know, redefining your own expectations that you set on yourself. But to me, it's like it's about being the change that you want to see in other people, and especially when it comes to relationships. And for a lot of the listeners of the podcast, you know, I hate trying to be one of those people as other entertainers or media personalities is like, you know, if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? Because to me, it's like, I want you I want you to discover those things on your own. And I hope that this show sets you in that direction, gives you the tools to explore it further. I don't want to answer that question for you. I want you to answer that question for yourself. And one way that I like to think about it is, you know, I get a lot of listeners on Grindr. They message me sometimes. They're like, how can I can't get a man to love me. How can I, you know, they sound like Effie and Dreamgirls, you know, he must love me. And I'm like, Effie, you can't change. It's really hard to change other people, but you can change yourself. Mm. And that was the message of Dreamgirls, right? You know, the song I'm Changing. It's like you ultimately.
That was written for the movie.
But that's to, you know, the message of the show is that she is able to overcome because she looked inside her and said, I'm going to change. Mm. I'm not going to be depending my happiness on other people. Ultimately, it's like I want to be the agent of the change that I want to see in others. Mm. And so if we want to if you want people to be more compassionate, the only way to really bring that compassion is to be more a compassionate person and to put yourself in really painful, horrible, awkward situations where you can grow as an individual. You know, and so for me, like this past year, I've been sort of exploring all that on my own very quietly. And it's like there are some days, baby, I was just like, what have I gotten myself into? But that's a whole nother podcast. How do you be the change that you want to see in others? You know, what is something that you personally are struggling with or growing as a person to be a better individual?
You know, especially in the age of social media, oftentimes I'm thinking, and what is what I am sharing with other people is the how has the energy I've transmitted uplifted people versus, you know, brought them down? What am I doing to build other people up and to help them? And what may I be doing that may be causing harm? And I think if we are honest with ourselves about that, more accountable to that, then we can find ways that we can really support each other. But not only that, really figure out what is it in me that I'm struggling with? Am I acting out on that in really toxic ways? And what can I do to change that? Does it mean sometimes I need to listen less or not listen less, talk less and listen more in certain conversations versus taking up space, especially when, for example, the N-word, you know, there are a lot of white people on social media, you know, really giving hardcore opinions about this. And I'm like, okay, I understand we all want to be part of the conversation and no one's saying don't be part of it, though sometimes it's like, all right, this does not directly affect me as much. Maybe I need to be listening to the people it directly affects the most and taking my cue from them and seeing how they're discussing this. Let them take the lead. You know, we don't always have to be the center of everything. Mm-hmm. It's not always about us. Most things rarely ever are about us, especially with relationships and other people. You know, so I think once we get a lot more self-aware, and once we are holding ourselves accountable to what we're putting out there and getting the getting people in our inner circle who can help us do that and not be yes people, I think we'll be in a better place.
Do we sometimes find ourselves arguing with ourselves about things that we don't like in us and others?
How do you mean that?
You know, it's like I always say, it's like the things you don't like about your boyfriend is really think, you know, you wound up with this person because they're a reflection of you.
Yeah.
And so if you're like not liking that person, you know, you're really arguing with yourself sometimes.
Right. And then you have like the white people that like that chime in about these things on race and stuff like that. It's like they're really trying to justify in many ways their own internal racism, I think. And so that's why they have to offer these kinds of opinions instead of just being like, hey, I'm going to listen to you and take in what you have to say.
I like this idea that I heard, and I'm not sure where I heard it from, but it's like when someone calls you a racist, your answer should be thank you.
Why?
Because it's an opportunity to grow as a person. It's to say, you know what? I didn't realize that. Tell me more. You know, I'm ready to listen. It's an opportunity to grow as an individual. And so many people, when they're accused of being bigoted or discriminatory, they got on the defensive. They're like, no, I'm not. You know, you are. You are the racist because you have a double standard. Whatever. You start negotiating. And maybe it's just a time to say, if someone says you're an asshole, shut up and listen.
You know, one of the, you know, best nuggets of wisdom that's been passed to me in the last few years, you know, of doing a lot of writing work was when a presenter on a lot of, you know, feminism issues in digital media, especially as it relates around online harassment and trolling, you know, presented as part of their workshop, an article by Anne Friedman. I think it ran in New York Magazine, and it's called The Matrix of Disapproval. And it's a really handy, easy to understand drawing and also accompanying article that really helps you filter criticism. And it's based on people who know you personally versus people who don't, and people who are familiar with what you do or what your work is versus people who don't, who aren't familiar with you. And you have people who are your haters, you know, who know your work, don't know you personally, but they can't stand you and they're kind of icky. And you have the people who don't know you at all, don't know your work at all, nothing about you at all. Those are the people who, when they like are charging back, you know, they're spewing out ad hominems, really hateful language. It's very clear that they're not there to engage with you. They are there just to bash you for fun's sake. Those are the trolls. And then on the other side, you have the critics, the people who know your work, but don't know you personally, but they know what you've done. And what they're sharing is in a way constructive. They're trying to help, not hurt. They're saying, we are looking at what was done. We're looking at the work. This is what we think needs to improve. And then that sweet spot, the people who know you and they know what you're doing, they know your work. Those are the people who are worth their weight in gold. So those people, you can call me like, hey, I wrote this or I said this. What was I out of line for that? Mm-hmm. And you know, you got people around you and you know, you got people around you that are great people when they say, yeah, you effed this up and you need to fix it. Not the people who are going to always tell you you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Not the people who are always tell you you're perfect. Because none of us are. So I think
unless you're Valentina from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Or Tyler Perry.
No notes back on my copy, please.
Mm-hmm. I like that we came full circle.
It's all this stuff is somehow interconnected. It always is.
Yeah, that's what happens when you do a lot of drugs. It's like, hey, man, we're all the same. We're all in the fish tank. When I fart, you smell it.
And then I farted out, too, right?
Yeah, I smell your farts, you know? So sometimes it's like, we're all each other's farts. Think about that.
But they say the farts, though, actually have cancer-causing properties. Oh, no,
curing
properties, the sulfur in them.
There's fucking science behind that. When someone farts and you smell it, say thank you. Because they're reducing the odds. There's science behind this. They're reducing the odds of you catching cancer or developing cancer.
So is this an argument for everybody eating more Chipotle or something?
I don't fart with beans. Do you? I'm from Puerto Rico, so I do. I'm used
to it. Faustin grew up on beans, so your body is used to it, whereas my body is not.
I am DNA rice and beans, baby. It's like, I eat that shit, I'm like, da, 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 da. You know, and people in Wisconsin can eat all the cheese they want to. You give me that much cheese, like cheese curds, I'll die.
Yeah,
I'm just like,
yeah, I was raised by Southern transplants, so every kind of bean, I've had it every kind of way, so it I'm all right.
Derek Clifton, people can follow you on social media.
They can. I'm on Twitter at Derek Clifton, and
it's spelled D-E-R-R-I-C-K.
Correct.
And Clifton, not Clinton.
Not Clinton, but not a bad association. Yeah. Not all bad.
And you're also on Facebook.
Indeed. I'm on there as well. I'm fluttering around.
And you kind of took a little break from writing, though, because you just started a new job, which we won't go into. But you just wanted to take a little bit of a breather to get your bearings straight.
Yeah, you know, I think in every writer's life, and a very wise writer told me this maybe a year or so ago, there are periods of stillness. And I mm-hmm. think those periods are, you know, times where we have the chance to really reflect on our work, think, okay, what am I doing that I like? What am I doing that I don't like? Can I take this in new directions? And I think this has been that season for me. You know, I had a really great run with a column at the Chicago Reader that focused on identity and culture and really went hard in on the election and ended mm-hmm. up winning a national award and a local journalism award. I'm really proud of that and happy about that, especially since a lot of the work that was done really put a lot of marginalized folks at the center of the conversation and took it away from all the hype media sensationalizing and really took those national trends and put it in real, relatable terms with real people. Mm. And that's work that I appreciated doing. So I'm seeing the future being similar in terms of what I'll continue writing, though I'm still kind of figuring out what that new direction is going to be. And I'm excited about that, not scared.
But every writer needs to take a little break sometime to
agree
to reorient yourself and to get your head together, right?
If you're always going at full speed, mm-hmm. If you're always, you know, beating the drum, you're never going to take a chance to rest and regroup and really listen to, you know, your where you're at and kind of feel where your wavelength is and where your energy is and then figure out where would I like to be and which direction I want to go in. That's why I don't like artists and musicians who like make an album every year. It's like, no, let us forget about you for a bit. Go live and have some experiences and then bring that into your work. Mm-hmm.
Wise words, wise words. I want to remind people too, we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member, you can do that today and sign up at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes the show happen. We don't have any advertisement, although we would take it if we had it. So if you want to advertise, just email us at mail@feastoffun.com, but otherwise support us. Make a donation at feastoffun.com/donate or visit our store at feastoffun.com/store. We have fantastic t-shirts for sale. Get yours in time for Pride.
Unlike, you know, game show hosts where their wardrobe is furnished by Botany 500. Whoever the fuck is Botany? You know, you watch it, the game show, like The Price is Right.
They make suits.
They make suits.
Yeah, you can find Botany 500 easily at any Burlington co-factory.
But we are furnished, or where the clothes are furnished by the Feast of Fun fashion line. And you can get our t-shirts at feastoffun.com/store. We get Not Shaving Gives Me More Time for Misbehaving and Hunty University, where the library is always open because it's always a good time to start reading. You know what I'm saying? You know, point it out, speak your truth, get your groove back. Own a business, step your pussy up, suck a dick. Something
okay,
like that.
Okay, T.S. Madison, I see you.
One of the wisest
I want her to pick me up and go for a ride in her car.
Yeah, she's like taking on Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars with coffee. And she's actually going to eat something.
Oh, she eats.
They go out to eat and stuff. Mm. And I'm like, that T.S. Madison, she's a brilliant mind.
She's a powerhouse.
You know, she convinced World of Wonder basically to pay for her to go out to eat all the time. I'm like, girl, that is so good. And then now she's like, she's doing her own cooking show on Facebook Live. And it's literally like her and her mother and their kids, because she's taken up, you know, rest in peace, Auntie Fee, who's no longer with us. She's started taking Auntie Fee's mantle, and she's cooking up pork chops and, you know, star frying stuff. And, you know, it's T.S. Madison and Miss Mary, her mother, and they're not the best cooks. You know, they're just cooking and talking to each other, and it's what it's like to hang out at T.S. Madison's chalet in Atlanta.
The mansion.
The mansion that she has. But I'm a big fan, and she's a great person. And you can watch our Cooking with Drag Queens with T.S. Madison at our YouTube channel, youtube.com/feastoffun.
Ding!
And our Kickstarter for season 3 of Cooking with Drag Queens with behind-the-scenes interviews with the top comedy queens, including Willem Belli talking about why DWV broke up.
Mm-hmm.
Never before discussed is going to be available exclusive first to our Kickstarters, and that's coming later this month.
So start following us on Kickstarter. Just search for Feast of Fun, and we're right there.
Interviews with Lady Red Couture, Heclina, Peaches Christ, Alaska, talking about the hailstorm that happened at the VH1 Awards. The MTV Music Awards, excuse me. Willem Belli and I'm blanking out on some names. Sasha Soprano and
Peaches Christ, Heclina, Lady Jackie Beat.
Jackie Beat, Coco Peru. How can we forget Coco Peru and a bunch of other people talking about their relationship to food, what it's like to hang out backstage with these queens. It's quite. And Bob the Drag Queen, who feels like she said, I've lived a million lives since I last saw you.
Bob says Trinity's going to win season 9 of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Trinity Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I was thinking
the tuck.
Yeah, the tuck.
As they call her
because she tucks hard.
So she's the first pageant queen that's probably going to take it. Mm-hmm. And of course, people in Chicago already used to disappointment in the sense they wanted Kim Chi to win.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, Kim Chi obviously didn't win because Bob won.
Mm-hmm.
But now we feel like with Shea Coulee, she's likely to take it. So it's a really, really close call between Shea and Trinity.
I know. Chicago people were all rooting for Shay, of course.
Fuck Trinity. Although I love Trinity on social media, she's fantastic.
I love her too. I wouldn't be mad if she won, but it's just like, it's time a Chicago girl wins.
It's time Shea Coulee had her way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I kind of feel about like RuPaul's Drag Race, how I felt about American Idol after a few seasons when I watched it, where it's like, if you get far enough in the finals,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter if you win the crown or not. You're still gonna, you know, play at universities or your club. People are gonna want to get you for stuff.
You do get a higher booking fee, I think, if you win.
Slightly.
Maybe. But hey, you can win a crown and then, you know, easily become irrelevant later. Mm. Like, I'm sorry. Like, even like, for example, like, what was it? Season 2 Exactly. Like, I don't really think about Tyra anymore.
I remember her name.
Well, you know why? Because you met her.
I met her. She sat right where you're sitting.
And she's like, I can't believe I won RuPaul's Drag Race.
Ho, ho, ho. She sounds like, what's the
Huckleberry name? Hound.
Huckleberry Hound.
I don't know. For me, and my friends talked about that during that season. I think it was around the same time that Wendy Williams, had this heavy critique of how Beyonce interviews, at least at the time. She was like, Beyonce talks like she has a fourth grade education. It's slow, it's drony, it's real country. And I'm like, we were like, that's kind of messy. But then we saw like Tyra on the show, and we're like, actually, Tyra has a very similar interview style to Beyonce, but it's a little exaggerated. Kind of plays this idea of, like, I guess, you know, being a mess and failing, as you all like to say drag is. But also, like, Tyra was very clearly a member of the Beehive, like when she like annoyingly sang Halo in the workroom, off key and in screeching pitch.
She was gorgeous, though, and she won a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she got herself a new grill, honey. But she looks fabulous.
Yeah. And again, it was like you were talking about people and their expectations back then. RuPaul felt like we really needed to show that drag was like beautiful. You know, these people looked good. Because back in the day, if you weren't a gorgeous drag queen, you couldn't get any kind of like marketing gigs. The people always, like, if they wanted to hire a drag queen, she had to be like more of a female illusionist, that kind of thing. And so that's where the first 3 seasons came from. And then they're, after that, they're like, well, Sharon breaks the mold.
Yeah, look at her. She's now dressed up as Kathy Griffin with Trump's head.
She recreated it.
And that was exciting. I was like, Sharon Needles is back. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's causing up a storm.
She's listening right. Fausto, I never went anywhere. Fuck you. Give me another shot.
Guys, thank you so much for listening. Derek Clifton, thank you for coming.
Thank you all. This is great.
Come back again, please.
I will. All right. Bye-bye. I'll have more fun.
Bye-bye.
A feast of fun. That's the bus.
What is that noise?
That's a bus outside.
Oh. Oh,